This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, April 18th, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. How technology can affect us as individuals has broad implications for public policy, and our beliefs about the future of technological progress is expressed in and shaped by our culture. Kimberly Hurd Hale is author of The Politics of Perfection, Technology and Creation in Literature and Film. We discussed what art has to tell us about where technology might lead society.
I wrote this book because I think that popular culture is very important to academics, yet it often is, unfairly maligned, that not enough attention is paid to it, that there tends to be a focus on, elite culture, on, high culture. And in a democracy, I think that's kind of dangerous, that a democracy is driven by public perceptions and public moods and public beliefs. And popular culture reflects that, going back to ancient Athens. And, you can see that, Socrates and Plato, they went to the theater. They attempted to understand what the people liked, why they liked it, what the mood of the public was, as a way of informing political institutions and political behavior, a way of understanding the life of the city. And I think that that's very important in any democracy, to understand what the public is talking about, why they're talking about it, why we're suddenly seeing a surge in dystopian tales in popular culture. What does that mean? I mean, there are easy answers, of course, that the popularity of one franchise means that 10 franchises will come after it. But I think it is still worth examining what these artifacts of popular culture are actually saying in terms of serious political and philosophical discourse.
So the first thing we're going to talk about is Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Now, what stories was that based on?
What story was it based on?
Yeah, some things came before, but where are the strongest parallels that we find with Metropolis with things that existed before?
That's actually a very difficult question, because Metropolis is generally considered the first science fiction film. So you can see kind of philosophical echoes of it going back to Plato's Republic, the idea of the tripartite city and what that means in terms of balancing efficiency with liberty, with allowing people to improve themselves versus, having the most productive structures in your society. So that's the parallel I draw in the book between Plato's Republic and Lang's Metropolis, how both of them contend with a society divided by class and what the implications are for liberty, for individual liberty.
So in Metropolis, you have this sort of overclass of wealthy elites who are titans of industry / government in a way.
Yes.
It's very, very, very merged sense of government and industry. And the young people, the children of the wealthy, they just cavort around and play and make out and play sports and that sort of thing, and are engaged in these sort of what are, I guess, viewed as young people pursuits.
Yes, yes. And leisure pursuits.
And there's this huge underclass that actually is running literally running the machinery of industry and the state at the same time.
Yes.
And they revolt.
Yes.
But it's not a happy story.
No, it is
and
not.
In any sort of standard Hollywood picture, that revolt might very well be the end of the story.
Yes, that's
end
the
of
victory.
The movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
yes,
it.
Yeah. Yeah, so Metropolis is also fascinating, I think, in terms of Platonic philosophy, because, Plato, of course, identified parental love for their children as kind of the key flaw in any sort of massive social engineering project, that people will not be able to accurately evaluate their children's talent or their children's intelligence or their children's ability, and this will lead to the collapsing of any sort of engineered society. And you can already see this in Metropolis as well, that we don't know how long the city has functioned the way it is presented in the film, but you can see that will the children of the wealthy class who just spend their lives cavorting in this garden be prepared to take on the role of government, to be prepared to run the city once they reach an arbitrary age? I mean, it seems unlikely. The children of the workers, you can also see, you know, in the revolt, the workers forget about their children. The children are almost killed in the flood. They would have been killed in the flood without the intervention of Maria. And so you can see already that the disconnect between the generations is going to be problematic for the city and metropolis, even without the revolt, that there's already an unwillingness to treat the children the way they need to be treated in order to prepare them for ruling.
And there's a moment there where they bring a group of children into the room where all these young people are just playing around and being—I don't know if it's lazy is the right word, but just partying basically.
Yes.
And they're just like they're sort of taken aback by this chunk of humanity that they've forgotten and that they feel guilty about, and then that carries some of the plot line through the rest of the film.
Yeah, it even seems as though the children of the wealthy class had never seen anyone from the underclass. That you know that the rulers of the city are familiar with the city of the workers, as it's called. They've been down there. They know what it's like. But the children of the wealthy class give no indication that they even knew the city of the workers was there. They had no idea what really was happening to facilitate their leisure, their party in the garden. they don't know, and so they are not evil so much as ignorant of what is going on below them.
But the solution that is decided upon is revolt.
Yes, is revolt, and again, it's not a happy revolt.
Led by this woman who was like a machine, who then turns into like this goddess.
Well, the revolt is initiated by the robot who has been designed to take on Maria's likeness. So Maria, the real woman, was a kind of political revolutionary in the worker class, but she preaches harmony and unity. And then the ruling class instead forms a robot in her likeness to really stir up the workers and cause them to revolt as a means of cracking down, as a means of giving them an excuse to regulate the workers even more harshly. And so you have this dual figure of the robot Maria and the human Maria and the different sides of revolution and which one will be more successful.
How was that film viewed at the time and in subsequent decades?
It really was unfairly associated with the Third Reich in the decades after it was released. That I think the fact that the film did not view the workers' revolt as an unmitigated good, as the end of a happy story of overthrowing tyranny, was really objectionable to many film critics.
So it was the wrong revolution.
The wrong revolution, yes. Because again, the city is not okay at the new metropolis. The workers are not going to be able to form some sort of happy communist utopia or even be able to understand democracy. There's no indication that there's been any sort of civic virtue or civic education in this city. And so it's really just in a place of chaos. And this was really objectionable to a lot of critics who viewed it as needlessly subtle would be a way to put it. And again, the central love story of Metropolis was dismissed as sentiment by many critics, which, again, I think unfairly, because the love story is critical to the success of the new society. The only way that Metropolis survives the revolution is if they all remember that they love one another, that they have, these ties of family and friendship, and they should not seek to oppress one another.
It's a common humanity.
Yes, a common humanity.
Another piece that you look at in your book is Kazuo Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go, which I will, because there are spoilers coming, I would recommend anybody to read that book and stop right now and go read it and don't read anything about it.
They should have read it already.
Just go read it. Just don't, but don't listen to anything else about it until you've gotten about halfway through.
Yes.
So that book details children at Hailsham, which is a boarding school.
Yes, a boarding school,
sort
yes.
Of,
yes.
But it's not really a boarding school.
Yes, but it plays on this kind of American, in particular, American kind of fantasy of the English boarding school, where you see this, you know, repeated constantly in films and books, that we have this ideal, idealized version of the British boarding school, where you go and you play with your friends and you learn the great books and everything is wonderful. But then, of course, it's gradually revealed that the wonderful education they are receiving at Hailsham is kind of just cover for the very dark destiny that awaits the clones.
Yeah, it's for naught.
It's for naught.
We haven't mentioned it yet, but all these children are clones.
They're all clones.
And
yes,
they are in fact organ factories.
Yes,
and it's so weird because the parallels between Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go and Remains of the Day are mm-hmm. so strong
yes.
in terms of like the internal monologue
yes.
of characters who are trying to make right
mm-hmm.
either the choices they've made or the life that has just been thrust upon them.
Yes, yes. It's told from the point of view of one of the clone children, and it's not a story of revolution. It's a story of her growing up, having friends, falling in love, reconciling herself to the fact that she will die before she reaches middle age, that she will donate her organs one at a time in a very cruel manner, that she will spend her last years caring for her fellow clones as they make these organ donations and have to watch her friends be slaughtered by this bureaucratic system that has been solely responsible for her creation and her education and controlled every aspect of her life, to the point where she does not resist. None of the clones resist. They accept their fate. They show no indication that they would be able or willing to escape their destiny. They think that that is what they were bred to do, and really there's very little indication that they find it morally objectable.
It's very British.
Yes, 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 yes.
So in that story, how much of a sense do we get of why this was done, of the sort of the backstory mm-hmm. of this is how we got to this, you say it's cover for mm-hmm. this horrific process mm-hmm. where people are have their organs harvested one by one. They go through these long recoveries only mm-hmm. to then have another organ harvested. And then they'll die, of mm-hmm. course, when they lose a sufficient number of vital organs.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the story is set in the late 1990s in Britain. And the premise is that following World War II, rather than the kind of breakthroughs in nuclear power that we experienced, there were instead breakthroughs in medicine. So we figured out a way to clone human beings and use their organs to essentially cure cancer, cure heart disease, all of the kind of, you know, great mass killers of our society. We can use the clone organs to cure them. And this means that ordinary human beings no longer have to fear cancer. They no longer have to fear heart disease or liver disease. They no longer have to worry that their family members will die prematurely from these things. And so the society is willing to accept this program of breeding and raising and slaughtering clones in exchange for longer life, longer, healthier life. And Never Let Me Go examines it from the point of view of a society that wants these organs desperately, but also seemingly recognizes that it is a seriously inhumane, unethical thing that they are doing. And so then you get Hailsham. You get the idea that if we educate these clones in a, you know, classical sense, we give them classical educations, they read the great novels, they learn about philosophy, they spend most of their time doing art, that then somehow it's more humane what we are doing to them. And you see this again in their long recovery periods. That,
it's a,
yeah.
like a Potemkin respect for
yes.
their individuality
yes.
and their natural human rights.
Yes, they're given names. It's recognized that they have human drives, that they benefit somehow from these educations. And so you have to ask, you know, if it's worthwhile to allow them to read Jane Austen, then how are they, then how is it acceptable to harvest their organs as though they were not sentient beings.
How was that book received? Because I know Remains of the Day was huge, was a huge success and very critically well received. But how was Never Let Me Go? How has it been perceived?
Very positively, that it is considered, I think, a modern classic, that it's, I think, to me, of course, it's very important. And I've never met a person who has not viewed it with some sort of awe. So I think, very well received by both critics and the public. Not as widely read as I would, of course, hope, but there
are so many stories that are very similar, both in the technical details of the plot. So there was Coma in the 70s, which was based on a Michael Crichton book. Is that right?
I think so. Yes.
And then like The Island, which was a sci-fi movie that was not great, but it sort of detailed some of the similar elements. Mm-hmm. But also the idea that there is. What we're doing is okay as a government, as long as we're providing civilization to these people at some point. So I'm thinking of Heart of Darkness.
Yes.
Where, as long as we're doing the war is fine. The slaughter is fine. The killing all these people is fine, but because we're civilizing them in the process.
Yes, and it's, I think, very closely related to Hannah Arendt's idea of the banality of evil, about how these atrocities just get normalized into society, so that it becomes very difficult for us to even see our behavior clearly, that we cannot really see the things that we are doing. Without, I think, these reflections of popular culture, that we can't really begin to separate ourselves from our own behavior, from our own beliefs, until someone gives us an outsider perspective through the view of a clone, for example, so that we can really see. I mean, to me, I think Never Let Me Go, it is, of course, science fiction, but I think it's eminently realistic that it I can easily see a bureaucracy developing in this direction.
Yeah, and it has a lot of the best elements of science fiction in that it talks about the story that arises in a world where these things are common.
Yes.
And not so much, let's talk about the technical details of the science.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You mentioned the banality of evil, and of course, if we're talking about fiction here, the character that comes to mind for me is a Dolores Umbridge from the Harry Potter series the technocrat who allows evil to flourish in the Ministry of Magic in the Harry Potter series, because she's more engaged in the process of asserting and establishing control than she is about doing what is right.
Yes, I think, Dolores Umbridge is a great example of this, that it's all related, I think, to the impulse towards perfection, the idea that efficiency and perfection and control are goals worth pursuing in themselves, this reaction against the messiness or an inefficiency of humanity. And I think that you can see this in a lot of science fiction, but yes, Dolores Umbridge is a great example of the same impulse in humanity to eliminate flaws without seeing that those flaws are, in fact, our strengths, or the things that make our life worth living, the individuality, the relationships you form, outside of the kind of strict structure of your life, of society. These are the things that make life wonderful, that make life beautiful. And so I think that is fits in perfectly with what the book is really getting at.
And her great line, or her great exchange in the book, is like with Harry Potter, where she's taken over the post of the Defense Against the Dark Arts class. And she's teaching them out of books. Mm-hmm. And Harry asks her, "So, what good is any of this going to be in the real world?" And she says, "This isn't the real world.
Yes.
This is school."
Yes. And I think it's very interesting that you also see that impulse to protect the children, as we said, the same impulse as you see in Metropolis. This, and of course, she's doing it for nefarious reasons. But you see echoes of this in our own society. You see echoes of it throughout popular culture. This idea that children need to be protected, while they are, of course, the victims of all of these horrible societal movements that the adults inflict upon them.
The third piece that you talk about, and you talk about other items mm-hmm. as well, but the ones I wanted to talk about is the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind.
Yes.
And you have a basic plot here. Mm-hmm. A man who has undergone a very devastating breakup, and he wants to erase it from his mind. What are the critical elements that jump out about that?
So it's related to an idea from Aeschylus, actually, the tragedian of ancient Athens, who has probably his most famous line is, wisdom comes from suffering. He says, wisdom comes alone from suffering. The idea that human beings cannot be wise unless we suffer, that it's the pain that teaches us, initially teaches us how to survive. You don't touch the stove because someone touches the stove, it's hot, you learn not to touch the stove.
There is no coming to consciousness except through pain.
Through pain, yes. And so initially you learn to survive this way. And then as you grow into an adult, hopefully you learn how to be a good person this way. You learn not to hurt others, because when people hurt you, you feel bad. You learn to not make the same mistakes over and over again, because it leads to suffering. And so Aeschylus believed that this type of suffering is what allows us to come closer to truth, to become philosophers, to transcend the basic animal existence that human beings start at, to become human in some very important ways. And Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind examines that, the impulse in humanity, especially I think in modern humanity, to use technology to eliminate suffering, which is of course sometimes very good. We can use medicine to eliminate disease, that's wonderful. But we have to be careful not to conflate, say, needless suffering with useful suffering. And the breakup that Joel and Clementine go through in the film is useful suffering. It teaches them about the mistakes that they made in their relationship. It teaches them things about themselves that they may not have known. And Joel realizes this, of course, partway through the film, that he needs this relationship with Clementine, because he is a different person without it, a completely different person without this relationship. And he's in some ways a better person with it, with the suffering. He will learn from it and grow. And
part of the thing part of the process that he goes through is to eliminate any memories that remind him of this girl.
Yes.
Which includes very early memories of his life.
Yes, that her name is Clementine, and one of his foundational memories is being bathed as an infant by his mother while she sings My Darling Clementine. And so that memory is erased as something that is tied to his relationship with Clementine. And so the viewer is left wondering, how many of his foundational memories can be taken from him before he becomes a sociopath, before he becomes something completely different. You can't simply remove early bonding experiences with one's mother and expect to remain unchanged.
And so it's somewhere between sort of the Aldous Huxley world of elimination of mm-hmm. all suffering at great cost.
Yes.
And where we live today with antidepressants mm-hmm. and various chemicals that we, in many marginal cases, mm-hmm. can use just to feel a little better.
Yes. But, in Brave New World, to take it back to Huxley, the island where all the misfits go, where they're all sent, seems to be the best place. They request, I can't remember the fellow's name, the one who is a writer in Brave New World, but he says he wants to go somewhere with a bad climate, that he feels like he will be a better writer if he lives somewhere with a terrible climate, because the harshness, the suffering will make him wise, will make him invigorated and able to produce great art, whereas this kind of easy existence in a city with the soma, where you never have to feel bad feelings, where you're never encouraged to feel anything other than pleasant, is not conducive to his writing. And so I think you can see elements of that in Huxley as well. I didn't include Brave New World in the book because the scholarship on that is extensive, and so I didn't especially have anything new to say.
So some of the big lessons here that we should, I guess, take away from what you're writing and sort of the literature on this pop culture is how pervasive it is in these pop culture stories to forget our own humanity, to forget the humanity of others, and use technology as sort of a salve against having to actually recognize it.
Yes, that we forget. Living in a democracy is a great privilege, and our rights come with corresponding duties. That classical liberalism only works if society really works at it, that we have to remember that we have natural rights as individuals. No one gives you natural rights. They're ours to claim as individual human beings. In a democracy, it's our duty to ensure that our use of technology, that our public policies don't infringe on the natural rights of our fellow human beings. And of course, we extend that with civil rights, with the idea of limiting government to certain spheres, because that is the best way to preserve our individuality. That is the best way to, you know, carve out an area where we're free to develop art and philosophy and literature and politics and love and all of the things that make human life worth living. We can only do this if we take personal responsibility for doing it for ourselves. And so we have to be very active in how we perceive technology, how we ourselves use technology, and what direction our society goes in. That there's no way for, you know, government to limit the use of technology or the development of technology. That's, you know, one thing I get into in my book a little bit, that in an international society, if a technology is possible, it will be developed. Government policies forbidding the use or the development of human cloning will only last so long. Someone somewhere will develop human clones. Someone somewhere will develop artificial intelligence that rivals human intelligence. And so really the only defense against sliding into some of these technological dystopias is to personally refuse to do so, is to, you know, take personal responsibility for the way you use technology, for the way that those around you use it, to engage in public discussion of these things, to be purposeful with how we allow technology to be incorporated into our daily lives.
Kimberly Hurd Hale is author of The Politics of Perfection, Technology and Creation in Literature and Film. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.